some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Home of the Stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Rob, that's your cue. We're going to try this again, folks. We're going to press Rob's button again. Rob.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves, and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And here we are.
There we are.
We're here. I'm Rob.
I'm Garrett. Welcome to the show. Rob, how are you?
Did you hear me this time?
No, because
I'm great.
I don't. Well, I'm glad you're great, but I, you would think this is like the first rodeo that Rob and I have ever been to, because every week it's like I forgot the new intro, and then we can't figure out how to take Rob off of mute when the show starts, because Rob is always supposed to start the show. And you know,
I know. See, it, like me in my own shower, I am starting the show. It's just nobody else hears me. That's all.
Oh my!
And when
gosh.
I sing, so, that's a very good thing. I am not Garrett Miller. Well, let's just put that right
well, if
out.
If I could
there.
Have auto-tune in the shower, I'd sing every day. You know.
Yeah. There. You go. Well. Yeah. And then somebody had the good fortune of recording some of those, so that's great.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we've got a great show tonight. We're doing the show a half an hour early because Rob has a special event that he's going to be going to in a little bit. And he wanted to make sure that he got on the show, and we did it. So we just bumped the time back a little bit. So our time with our VIP special guest, our Wendy Michaels, will actually start at the top of the hour at 7 o'clock. But we're coming to you live at 6:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we're thrilled that you are joining us for this edition of Rated G Radio. And so, Rob, what's so special about today?
Well, what's special about today, actually, to be fair, the actual day was Saturday. And it wasn't even this last Saturday. It was something that happened 34 years ago.
Oh, my.
Saturday.
Do tell.
Yes. Well, 34 years ago, I was out doing my regular thing at that time. I was 24 years old. And my whole life revolved around drinking. And every night, I didn't know that it was possible to leave a bar before last call. Last call to me was when everybody was supposed to leave the bar. And so I had a whole drinking routine every night, all night. And this night was no exception. I left my usual bar, went out, got in the car because I drove drunk all the time, and put my key in the ignition, went into a complete and total blackout. I came to 2 hours later. There were lights flashing. I was like, what the hell? And as I came to, my car door was opening. What had happened was I was all the way across town. I was stalled in the left-hand turn lane in front of a police station.
Oh,
And so as they got me out of the car, my body was completely and totally drunk. But strangely, my mind was completely clear. And I can't tell you how weird that is to have this clear thought process going on in a body that is completely drunk. And so as they were putting me in the back of the police car, I heard a very clear voice in my head, that's it. That's the last drink you will ever have. And fast forward 34 years later, and this is with the help of others, that is true. I am now in my 35th year of sobriety as of Saturday.
Well, happy birthday to you. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Can we talk about this a little bit? Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely.
What happened when you got arrested?
Actually, what happened when I got arrested, I mean, this is sort of the weird logic. So I'm sitting there in this tank, and they did the breathalyzer on me, and I was 2.0, which policeman commented is like, you know, wow, you're somebody who drinks regularly because you don't get to 2.0 on, you know, one time or whatever. So they kind of clocked me with that. And, you know, it's past 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm thinking, okay, who do I call? And so I called some friends of mine who were drug addicts who had no money and no car.
Mm.
And a logical person to people to call to bail you out of jail at 4 o'clock in the morning. And lo and behold, they pulled together the money. They borrowed a car. They were there, bailed me out in a few hours and took me back to their place. And the whole next day, they were having me smoke marijuana because they too agreed that I shouldn't ever drink again. But to them, you know, I should just be loaded forever. So I stayed loaded that whole day. And ironically, this was, I mean, most people aren't going to remember this because it was 35 years ago, but this was right when the laws had just changed. Because it used to be years ago that if you got arrested for drunk driving, that you got kind of like a little slap on the hand and that was it. Then all of a sudden they changed the laws and made it a very, very big deal. And the laws had just changed. And the other person who got caught up in them besides me was Johnny Carson. And so
we
were watching programs about Johnny Carson's drunk driving when I too had joined the Johnny Carson Club. And that was what that day was about. And then the following day was actually the 5th of March, which is my anniversary date, which is the day that I was first completely clean and sober. So anyway, I called them and that's what happened from there. Then I had a trial and I had to pay a couple $1,000s and I could only drive to and from work. And then 7 years later, that drunk driving left my record. So,
well, first of all, I mean, I'm sure you've only talked about this 1,000 times, but you were so lucky that nothing else happened.
Oh, you know, I was on borrowed time. I mean, I was drinking in Hollywood and West Hollywood. I was living over in Burbank. So I was going over that hill every single night. And, you know, I taught myself how to drive drunk. I learned to look out the window and look at the line in the middle of the street and just
focus on
that the whole way.
Wow.
So, yeah, no, I mean, you know, I was a criminal, you know, it was not good.
So when you said to yourself, you know, this is going to be my last drink, what did you physically go through, withdrawals? What did you do mentally that, you know, was really something that helped you stay on the straight and narrow after that night?
What happened that night, I was profoundly done. You know, I looked at my life. I had this moment of clarity, which I think a lot of alcoholics do, is they have this moment of clarity where they get to reassess. And it's very easy to make a moment of clarity go away. You just take another drink. But, you know, in that moment of clarity, I looked at everything that was going on that night, and in my gut, I knew that if I continued drinking, it would not be the last time I saw a jail cell. It would not be the last time I missed work. It would not be the last time for all of that stuff. And so I got very clearly that that was my moment to step out. And I've never forgotten that. I've also, since that time, have made staying sober my absolute number one priority every single day of my life since then. That is the most important thing above all else, because everything else, you know, I have greater loves, but everything else will go away if I'm not sober. And, you know, one of my great honors is, you know, I have two 13-year-old boys and they have never seen their dad drunk. ever.
So did you have points in your early on sobriety where you were either tempted or, I mean, because I know you said, you know, I'm never going back, but did you ever find yourself put in situations where, you know, your, I don't know, your barometer was like, well, you know, I could just have one. I don't have to get drunk again, but, you know, I could sure have one or two.
That's a great question. I, you know, to be honest with you, I don't think I ever got there where I would, because that would, you know, where literally I was deluded about what I am or who I am. And that is the point of touching base on who I am, you know, every week and not forgetting that. I definitely had periods where things were getting dodgy, where, you know, I could see slipping and being in a place that I needed to do something to get away from the temptation. And, you know,
what are some of your triggers?
Honestly, I think for me at this point, things like boredom and lack of self-worth, you know, kind of in that depressive state,
yeah,
are worse triggers than something traumatic happening. Because when I'm in something that's really hard to deal with and that type of thing, again, I am very aware that taking a drink would be the worst possible, quote unquote, solution to it. And I just, again, as part of my personal intention around this is to keep it as my top priority. You know, whenever I'm evaluating my priorities, that I'm assess that. I assess that in that staying sober is my top priority. And I'll usually structure what I'm going to choose around that. In other words, you know, I have this week of all these things I have to do, you know, and maybe I can't do these other things. You know, will that affect my sobriety? If the answer is yes, then I'm not going to do them. You know, and I'm not going to, you know, and I watch myself in places where I could, quote unquote, accidentally slip, like in a loud bar. I don't order virgin, you know, margaritas or virgin pina coladas because I can't trust the bartender is going to hear me. I can't, you know, there are too many factors and I'm not really willing to set myself up for that risk.
So what do you
drink
when you go out?
Among other things, I have an allergy with alcohol where it literally sets up a physical craving. It isn't just, gee, I was in a sad place or, you know, that type of thing. It is literally an addictive substance to me.
So what do you drink when you go out?
I used to drink Diet Cokes. And I've gotten healthier with that. And I'll drink like a soda water or, you know, that type of thing. It depends where it is. One thing I've actually taken to a lot of times is just getting a cup of coffee. So, you know, I'm kind of going the other direction.
Caffeinating versus, you know, a depressant. Yeah. So, you know, take your pick on that. So is there anything that you miss about the drinking experience? What do you think that you thought about either yourself or what was happening when you would drink?
Okay. Two really actually very different questions there. And really good ones. The thing I actually miss because I was a wino, although I was a wino that drank, you know, the cheapest, crappiest wine because I was drinking in such volume.
Hell on Boone's Ferry Farm, you know.
Yeah. But it's like, after I got sober, I was like, it's like, damn, I was just getting to the French and German wines. You know, it's like, I'm doing it with taste, and then I quit. But I do, you know, I loved the taste of wine. I loved the, you know, a lot of the aesthetics of wine. And so I do miss that. The thing... And now I'm forgetting the second part of your question, which was also really good.
Well, I just forgot it too. But it's like, you know, I think that to me is a more interesting question is, you know, what do you miss about the drinking experience, you know, or what did you tell yourself you were getting from it, you know?
Right. Oh, that was what you asked. You asked, what was I thinking when I was drinking? The thing that is weird about it is what I was thinking, especially towards the end of the evening, because what would happen is after I left the bars after closing is I would go home. I usually stopped at some place that had food on the way, which is a whole other experience I'll tell you about in a second. But when I got home, I would drink some more until I passed out on the floor. I slept. I had a studio, but I slept on the floor almost every passed out on the floor almost every single night.
Wow.
And what I thought, and I remember thinking this, was kind of every drink was like, take that. And by take that, I mean like suicidal, take that. I was putting myself out.
Oh my god.
It was a dark place. It was the drinking had a dark place that it took me to. And, you know, the intention was for me to go out, you know, with that. But the one thing about stopping at places to eat, because there was a Copper Penny near where I lived that was 24 hours, and I would go in there, and my mind would sort of like film the experience, because I would replay this after I got sober. And the look on the waitress's face was always one of just disgust, like, you know, oh my God, this guy is so wasted, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I didn't react to him that way. But it was like their expressions got embedded in my memory for after I got sober. So I'd have to reflect on, ooh, that's how people were looking at me at the time.
So did you have other friends who were, you know, because it's really easy to say, you know, it's, well, you know, I was out with the guys and, you know, so we, you know, we all got tanked and it was a riot. Did you have other friends who were, you know, kind of in the same boat that you'd go and hang out with socially? You know, like that
almost
daily or on a regular basis?
Almost all of them. My best friends, the ones I really cared about, were all alcoholics that were worse than me. So I could point at all of them and go, you know, can't be because, oh, look at you. So they were them. I had one person who I considered my quote-unquote best friend who was not an alcoholic, but he was probably the most toxic individual you would ever want to be around. I mean, he was nothing but derogatory and nasty and, you know, put downs 100% all of the time. And after I got sober, that relationship completely went away. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't handle him sober. So he left.
Let me ask you about that, because, you know, when you make that decision to get sober, I think it changes a lot of the relationships that you have, because people have known you as a certain way. And when you're not that certain way anymore, good or bad, you know, your relationships change with them. And what were some of the things that you noticed in your relationships that you were having at that time, you know, work-wise, personally, family, that type of thing? How did people react when the real Rob showed up?
Well, it was complicated. The one relationship I was talking about literally just went away. And what I mean by went away was no confrontation, no talk, no, you know, this isn't going to work anymore, nothing. It just immediately drifted apart. It was like he needed me drunk. And he knew that too, I guess. But he just went. The other relationships, The one person who was like my real big co-alcoholic actually got sober a little bit before me. And he was the very last night of my drinking before that whole thing that I described happened. I ironically had agreed with him that I would show up at a recovery meeting. He was trying to get me to one that night. And instead I went out drinking instead of going to that. So he was already waiting for me, you know, to try to get me sober. And then other friends who were also alcoholics kind of followed suit. They all kind of got sober and Some of them made it, some of them didn't, you know, but that's how it kind of all went. And a lot of them I had very good sober relationships with that we became both sober. And
I
which
love
was kind of nice because it meant that what was between us was kind of real, even though it was under this whole alcoholic thing.
Well, it's not that I want to rain on this lovely topic of sobriety here tonight, but I would love, actually, if we could have a part two of this conversation and maybe talk about your experience that you're going to have tonight when you go to your meeting, maybe next week or the week after, have you kind of give us a little bit of a, you know, what happened then or what happened next and get us caught up to date on how your life changed. And I think, anybody who's listening will hear it's for the better. But you've got some other news you wanted to share tonight before we get to the half hour mark, take our break and bring Wendy on. So
I did. And, I'm feeling guesty here.
The conversations I've never had with you, Rob. So I'm just curious, especially
really
somebody
cool.
who's
it's
had
really
34
good.
Years of sobriety.
Yeah. And, your questions are phenomenal, actually. They're really,
I'm selfishly
really
asking because, I'm like, the people who know me, I mean, when I say, I just had my third birthday, and people are like, oh my gosh, that's great. And then Rob's like, well, I'm going to get my 34th. Can we, can we start the show half an hour early? And I'm very humbled by that because, where I'm at in my life, I don't even recognize that person from, 3 years ago and before. And, but I'm so fascinated by your level of commitment and just saying, this is what I'm going to do. So my hat's off to you. I'm very grateful that you've shared that with us tonight. And, I want to know more,
and I'm proud of you too, because it isn't not a big deal. Your 3 years are equally a big deal. So, I don't want to minimize them in any shape or form. So anyway, but,
yeah, thank you for that, though. I appreciate it.
No, and that's very, very sincere. So, shifting gears on something completely different, and I mean really completely different here. As I write blogs and been published on, a lot of the sites and everything else, my own blog site. I want to try something different because I wrote something about the current political scene, and I'm not sure yet that I want to publish it. So I thought, what the heck? Maybe I'll bounce it off Garrett and our listeners and, get some feedback and say yay, nay, whatever you think about it. But I thought I'd read it to you and see what you think.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Well, I love your writing anyway. So even if, you're reading the phone book and, if you wrote it, I would say that was great. But tell us about the article.
Well, I appreciate that. And, your singing is sort of in that same category.
Okay. Our Mutual Admiration Society is now in session, everybody. So we got it. Okay.
So the title of this, and hold on to your seats, is A Gay Dad Sounds Off on Donald Trump and Mark Rubio's War of Penises. Don't get me wrong. I appreciate male physique and anatomy. That would define the gay part of being a gay dad. I have a healthy appreciation. I don't particularly like when male genitals are referred to as junk. I consider them anything but, and quite frankly, I find the label a bit homophobic. As I was growing up, I was told that penises were no big deal, that, quote, every guy has one, and, quote, they are all the same. As a grown-up, particularly one with great transgender friends and associates, I can tell you that neither of those statements is true. I also know that many guys seem to like to talk about their penises. Over the course of the social media adventure, I have been a happy member, pardon the expression, of a number of online communities of men and dads. There is one mostly straight guy community and another that is made up of gay dads. In one of those communities, penis talk is constant, and in the other, it has never been mentioned as long as I can remember. Where penises are silent is the gay dad group. That is not to imply that all gay quote-unquote community sites are that way. There are obviously certain apps where people are more likely to represent themselves with an image of their intimate parts than they are of their face. In the gay dad group, private parts are not what we are about. Ah, private parts. Remember when the penis was treated that way? That is still the standard I have set with my sons, who are both 13 years old. I have raised them from birth and infancy after each was born to drug-addicted parents. Throughout, my goal has been to inspire self-worth, self-respect, and a sense of self-dignity in them. I understand that their bodies are private and worthy of protection. They also know to extend that respect and dignity to others. It is a lesson that apparently several of the GOP candidates never got, or if they did, have chosen to ignore. Here is my letter to them. Dear Mr. Rubio and Mr. Trump, gentlemen, and I use the term loosely, put your phallic illusions away. I cannot imagine what you each sought to gain by going to the genitals, but whatever it was, you are not getting the rise from it that you had hoped. Mr. Rubio, I blame you for this. You started this conversation with a likely calculation that reality TV star Trump could not resist the invitation to follow you. Your strategy to literally sink below the belt is actually pretty fascinating. Of all the candidates on the roster, you have been the one most outspokenly homophobic. You have heralded people who would not discriminate against LGBT people and expressed desire that they not be condemned for it. You unabashedly would love to see LGBT people stripped of our civil rights and ushered out of polite society. At the same time, you are dodging those darn gay rumors about you. Most do not give them credibility. No man has claimed to have had sex with you. The rumors are all based on you allegedly being in some pretty raucous male erotic environments. Was it you or a lookalike? Those who reject the conjecture outright cite your having fathered children and your anti-gay political career as proof to the contrary. For many of us with expertise in LGBT civil rights, we see both as typical covers for a closeted man with intense internalized homophobia. In any case, here is a tip for you. If you are trying to skirt rumors that you may be secretly gay, it would be advised that you not signal that one of your main thoughts about a fellow candidate is how big his penis is or is not. So yes, Mr. Trump, you were goaded into the temptation to talk about your penis. Since you had previously speculated on being sexually attracted to your own daughter, anticipating you might jump on this was not a leap. It does not, however, excuse your behavior. You both make me embarrassed. You make me ashamed of being an American. You make me ashamed of being a male. You make me ashamed of being a leader. Neither of you deserve to be in contention of representing me as any of those things. I don't agree with either one of you on your law and economic agendas, but those are not the things I look to a president to be about. I look for a person who brings a sense of decorum, class, and inspiration. The women in this race seem to understand the concept. I cannot imagine Hillary or Carly Fiorina going on about each other's body parts. Full disclosure, Ms. Fiorina was caught on live microphone criticizing Barbara Boxer's hair in their California senator race. So, Mr. Rubio, you couldn't have gone after the hair? Such an easy target? No, you had to go for the penis. As my sons grow into the men that I hope they become, I do not want them to be influenced by public leaders with no sense of propriety. I want them to emulate men with heart, compassion, and who embrace others, even their competitors, with decorum and grace. My dad was a Republican man. He embodied those qualities. I would be proud to have my sons emulate him, but not you, the men who see themselves as the ultimate Republican male of today. I hope they look to the gay dads of the world instead. The men who inspire are the ones who respect the physical being of others, strive towards compassion for their essence, and work to understand their principles, even in an effort to refute them. That does not describe either of you. If we are what we think about, you two are apparently a pair of, well, you get the picture.
And with that, it is time for our break. We'll come back with Wendy Michaels and more spirited conversation right after this from It Matters Radio, my shameless plug, and then Rainbow Brew.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Aye, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, a duff man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Oh, why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, laddie, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I ever heard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Garrett Miller. Check out my brand new album, Blonde Jesus, voted number one rock electronica, and the hit single, Gay Wedding.
It's a nice day for a gay wedding.
Buy your copy today at GarrettMiller.com.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
Rob, you know what time it is?
It's... Uh-oh. I don't know the answer to that.
It's time to bring our very special guest star on, Wendy
Michaels.
Oh,
I was hoping
that
would be
so gay. Wendy, welcome to the show. How are you, my dear?
Hi. I wasn't sure if you could hear me or not. Hi there.
Hi. We're so thrilled that you're here. When Rob found out you were going to be a guest tonight, Wendy, he's gone back to watch My Sister Is So Gay on YouTube about 30,000 times, I think, in the past week. So I'm so excited to have you here and to have you as a very special guest. And wow, what a treat to have you here.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. Yay. That means we have 30,000 more hits.
I hope so. Wouldn't that be great? At some point, you make a buck off of it. But
Just letting you know, we had Terry on the show, and I told Terry that he was my favorite, but I lied. You're my favorite.
I'll take it. That's okay. You can tell whoever you have on at the time that they're your favorite.
Right. Well, I'm a dad, so I know that trick.
Yes, I know. My mom knows that trick well as well.
So, Wendy, for everybody who's hearing your voice for the first time, this is, by the way, your first of many repeat appearances on the show, we hope. Can you give us a little bit of background about who you are and what led up to My Sister Is So Gay?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I actually met Terry Ray, who is a co-writer and co-producer and co-star in the show, about 25 years ago. Oh, I hate to say that out loud. We were living in L.A., and we were studying with Charles Nelson Reilly, who's a fabulous teacher of ours, and we started doing scenes together, and I always dreamed of doing a sitcom with him because he was always the funny to my straight, no pun intended. And, and so I guess it was about last year we got together. I went to Florida for a while, lived out here in the 90s. When sitcoms were really big, I'm sure you remember that. And then I moved back to Florida, and then I moved back to L.A., and we were having lunch one day, and we just started talking about doing a web series. He says that I said that we should do one, and he said he was too busy. I don't remember the specifics, and we decided to write it, and we decided to play, you can play my brother, I'll play your sister, and we'll call it My Sister Is So Gay, and that was really and truly about how it started.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah.
Yeah, Wendy, the one thing that I wanted to ask you about, though, because, you have such great characters on the show. Terry is great, and, Lonnie Anderson is fantastic, and, the whole thing is wonderful. Yours seems to be the character I really am the most fascinated with because it is the trickiest because you're playing somebody who is kind of in denial about herself.
Yes, exactly. She really just thinks that she has a charmed life up until her best friend sleeps with her husband. Yeah.
The thing that I love about your performance in it, and it's so vivid to me, is because of the subtleties of it. It just plays so authentically.
Thank you. It's funny. Terry and I have great chemistry together. I just adore him. And he and I have always played well that way together. He can be very big and broad, and I love that. And I can be very subtle and quiet. And so I think that works really well together. It always has, and I think it works really well together here. And we have, I don't know if Terry's been on the show, right? Did you say on your show?
He's been on once, but we want him back as often as we want you back, like every night.
Yeah, bless you guys. It's so wonderful. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. The characters that we created were very three-dimensional. We did everything in his apartment, and I would act them out. We have very different writing styles, and he would just, words and sentences would just flow out of him at the computer, and then I would get up and pretend like we were actually doing it while we were, writing it. And then words would come out, and then they would come together, and it was actually a pretty seamless process. We knew that when we were together, we were creating something that felt a lot of fun and very special, and the characters kind of just unfolded as we were writing.
So have you guys collaborated on other work before, or was this your first tag team event?
This is our first tag team event, if you can believe it. We have not. He's written a lot of other with other partners, but I've written some other works as well, but this is our first together. And I'll have to tell you, I don't know about other writing teams, how they work or how they feel, but when I tell people, oh, my God, I love my writing partner, it's so wonderful, they say, oh, gosh, you're lucky. As if that's
really?
Not the norm.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by
really?
That. Why would you choose to work with people that you don't love to work with?
Well, maybe you're thrown together under certain circumstances and you have to work on the same project together, I don't know. I'm kind of new at this. I just love it. I just love the whole process with Terry. And we work from start to finish as writers, as actors, as producers. It's really a godsend. I feel very blessed.
Wendy, Terry talked about this when he was on, and you just mentioned this a few minutes ago. So I know this means a lot to you. Can you tell us what it was like to work with Charles Nelson Reilly? He obviously had a huge imprint on both of you.
He did. And it's funny because people normally think of him from Match Game. They don't think of him as a legit director and teacher. And he was phenomenal. I can remember the very first, I can still remember this, I think it was like 1994, and I walked into class. You had to audition, for one thing, to be selected to be in his classes, but he wasn't stuck up about it at all. And so I auditioned. I did a monologue. He laughed, and he said, all right, come back next week. And I walked in the first day of class, and it was a scene study class. And a scene went up, and two people did it. And I swear to God, I thought they were, like, opening night ready, Broadway. I was so impressed. But then Charles stepped in, and what he would do is he would give his critiques. But he wouldn't criticize you. He would just elevate your potential in a way that made the scene pop like 100 times. And then you'd do the scene again with some of his notes, and it was magical. And the way that he spoke to you and the way that he treated everyone was like you were on Broadway. And you just, it changed my craft, and it changed, I know it changed Terry. And he actually ended up working with Charles in a movie that he did, Gaydar. I think it's Gaydar. No, not Gaydar. Is it Gaydar?
I think so.
Yeah. I'm not sure. So, and then there's this funny story we like to tell, because here it is, my first day of class. And it was a small studio off, you know, in North Hollywood, off by the railroad tracks. And Charles used to always joke, you know, oh, I just off here on the tracks, the railroad, teaching acting. He was so humble, and I had to go to the bathroom. And so in between scenes, I walked down, it was just about a 40 seat theater. And I walked to the bathroom, and the bathroom was behind the stage, and it plugged up.
No.
I was like, oh, seriously, what do I do? And like, if I plunge it, and it's just one bathroom, it's my first day of class, I'm so green, it's Hollywood, I'm going to be kicked out. So I just walk out with a smile on my face, stand under the lights, and I go, excuse me, Charles? And he just looks at me, and I said, the toilet stopped up. He says to me, oh, okay, well, don't worry about a thing. No, I'll be happy to take care of that for you, princess. So he just comes walking down the stairs, unplugs it, and from the next 2 years of studying, I would only be known as princess. Charles. I don't think he ever even called me my name after that. But he did it with love. He was a magnificent teacher, and he changed a lot of people's lives.
Okay, I think you've now ruined the term princess for me for life. I will never forget that story whenever anybody's called princess again.
Well, no, I'm going to remember that story from now on, Rob.
Yeah.
Anybody who plugs the toilet, we're calling him princess.
Right.
I guess I must have looked like, could someone do something with a toilet, please? But I didn't mean for it to come out that way. I was just like, I don't know what to do. I'm kind of stuck here. And he was obviously thinking I was asking him to please go and plug my toilet.
So, Wendy, getting back to the show here, My Sister Is So Gay, on the show page tonight, we've got a link that takes people right to YouTube so they can watch all 6 episodes. And this is really kind of put together as 6 separate episodes, but if you really wanted to mush it together to make a great half hour of TV, what was the strategy behind that?
Just that, to be honest with you. We wrote the episodes. We could only really afford to do 5-minute episodes. Created 6 episodes because we felt like the story kind of stopped then. And we also had that in mind, that this could sell as a pilot. You know, if you took out all the credits of the individual episodes and put them all together and strung them together, it's one half-hour comedy. It's probably like 25 minutes. And we wrote each episode with an arc, a beginning arc in episode 1 that ends in episode 6. So it is a true storyline all the way through. You could have it as one show.
How did sponsorship play into making this season happen?
Well, they are responsible for making this season happen. Our sponsors are Equality Vodka.
Yay, Bert and Doug.
Yep, Bert and Doug, which they are wonderful, 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 kind men. And Terry sent them the script, and they loved it, and they laughed, and they said, we want to sponsor you, and we want to give you money to do this. We were like, yay! You know, it's so funny when you write something. He and I wrote it, and we're like, okay, what do we do now? I don't know. What should we do? Okay, well, I worked with Sam Irvin before. Let's send it to him, see if he likes it, you know, like the Cheerios cereal back in the 70s. And Sam liked it, and he said, I'm on board. And we're like, oh, okay, what do we do now? I mean, we got very excited about it, but we would, every time we sent it to our first choice, they said yes. And once Bert and Doug said that they were going to sponsor the show, we said, great, we knew we were in business. And that's when we started sending the script out. So, and they've always been really supportive of us. And they came to the screening in West Hollywood last month or in January, and we've always been very excited about it. I don't know, this is my first time working with executive producers on my own project. They're lovely.
So on the show, you have this great rapport with Terry, you know, in terms of, you know, as very authentically brother and sister-y, you know, kind of relationship. What is it like, and how did you get the rapport with Lonnie Anderson, who plays your mom, and create the mother-daughter aspect to that?
You know, that's a great question. When she said yes, we were like, oh my God! And I wondered if I'd be like too intimidated to play her daughter. But you know, I found out when I first met her, and she wanted to do a reading of the show, and so we did a reading of the show. And the first time I met her, she's incredibly gracious. I don't know if you all had it, if you were at the, I know Garrett was at the screening. I don't know, Rob, if you were, but how incredibly gracious she was.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah. No, yeah. I get left out
pictures.
Of all Hollywood stuff.
Now,
she leaves me home.
when I first saw her, I was just like, Mumsy! And that's all I could think of to say. And I gave her a big hug. And I think we just became mother and daughter instantly just from that. And because my character is not lovey-dovey and actually prefers that she not touch me, and when she does, I wash my hands, it was easy not to fawn all over her because I just kind of slipped into character right away.
But it's still – but you still project – I mean, even though it's not, you know, cuddle-cuddle – like, I mean, it's not like 3-year-old with mommy, but it is, you get the real sense of adult woman with her mom. You know, I mean, it's that the connection is there. It's really great.
I love to hear that because I think when we were writing Amanda and Seth and those characters were unfolding as we were writing, we really understood in the writing their relationship to their mother. And that, I don't know if that makes sense, but we almost knew who they were in relation to the mom, so that when Lonnie stepped in as mom, we were so set in how we felt about her already. And she exceeded our expectations in terms of the characterization and added more than we had written on the page. So that became even more for us to work with.
Very cool. Okay, so when we have a guest on, we usually ask them something very off the wall. So here's your off the wall thing.
Yay!
Someone gave us a hint that you have a thing about elephants.
Oh, yes, I do. I'm an activist for captive elephants.
Oh,
and,
that's so
cool.
Really,
it is cool, and I have a really, really great story. That this is kind of like a God shot story because I didn't know I had a thing for elephants. And I had a friend of mine who was an actress in Miami, which is where I came from. And she said, I'm doing a play called Speaking Elephants by Terry Lawrence. And I play a zookeeper. Why don't you come see it? And I did. And up until that point, this was in 2008, I had no affinity towards elephants at all. I mean, I've always been a lover of animals, but not really towards elephants. And so I went to the show, and it's a true story of Wanda and Winky, who were a point of view of the elephant. So the actors kind of dressed similar to elephants, and it tells the story of their journey from the Detroit Zoo to a sanctuary in California called PAWS, Performing Animal Welfare Society, and it's a sanctuary. And how what happens to captive elephants physically and emotionally when they are held captive, and then what happens to them when they're given life in a sanctuary. And the play moved me so much. It just, my soul just woke up. And then I started following the captive elephant situation in the United States, and I ended up volunteering at Zoo Miami to get closer to the elephants there. But now here's the story. Here's the crux of the story. When my nephew was about a year or 2 years old, me and my partner would take care of him on the weekends a lot. And we had a second bedroom. And we bought him a comforter set, and he's 30 now. And I, because that was such a special time in my life, I carried it, and I move a lot, I carried that comforter with me everywhere I went, all the time. Wherever I moved, I never put that comforter in storage. I always kept it with me. So about, I don't know, in 2010, I'm sitting here, and my cats love to play on the comforter, so I had it spread out over the floor in the living room, and they were playing and jumping on it. And I was talking on the phone, and I looked over at it, and for the first time, I noticed that the design of the comforter had a ring of elephants around the base.
Oh, my gosh.
I was like, never. I mean, I think I bought this in 1986, 87. I'd never noticed it. And so I knew that somehow my destiny would be with elephants. So that's my elephant story.
Wow. So how do you stay involved today when you're so busy?
Well, because it's my passion and I love it. You know, when we love something, we find the time to do it, and it's important to me. And I can do it from anywhere on my computer. I'm not the one that goes out there. I used to be, but go out there with the sign and say, don't come here, don't do this. But now I do everything behind the scenes. I write letters.
How can we help?
How can we what?
How can we help?
Yeah, how can those of us who are elephant ignorant get more involved?
That's a great question. The first thing you can do is not go to zoos and circuses. That's a real tangible thing. Is to not support zoos and circuses.
Okay, you realize my kids are now 13. This is a little late news, that one.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are certain zoos in the country that, like the San Diego Safari Park, has, I think, a herd of elephants. I think they have 14 or 15, and they have huge space. They spent $50 million. To make an elephant exhibit. So there are zoos in the country that have accommodated the space that elephants need, but most of them have antiquated areas for elephants to live in. So just, you know, like the Oakland Zoo is one, I believe, that has a large space. So there are a handful that, I don't want to be like one of those, you know, say, don't come within 400 feet of me while you're smoking a cigarette.
No, it's actually a really good conversation because, the perspective is, I know when it took the boys to the zoo when they were little, the feeling was, oh, thank goodness they have these animals put in safe places. I mean, that is kind of the feeling you walk away with.
And I think that you're absolutely right. I think the consciousness is changing and that we're learning more and more that about, you know, large mammals and what captivity does. They actually experience PTSD from being held captive. You know, elephants walk about 30 miles a day, and arthritis does not exist in wild elephants. And it's the predominant, you know, illness and affliction, I guess, in captive elephants because they don't have a lot of space and they just stand on concrete or they just stand all day. So, and they're, you know, they are... They show grief, they show emotion, they grieve other than the death, they have consciousness, they're aware of each other. So as we learn more, you know, about animals, I think the way that zoos move will be different. You know, a lot of zoos are starting to get rid of their elephant exhibits and their large mammal exhibits because they get it. You know, remember the movie, Blackfish? What is it? About
right.
The whale? And how that's changed the consciousness of SeaWorld.
But, I saw that and I just, like, I keep thinking of those poor whales, you know. But I don't know. What do you think? Well, this is off topic because now you've asked about what you brought up the whales. What do you think about SeaWorld trying to, you know, appease the public by building these, you know, tanks that are supposedly three times bigger or however many times bigger than what they're already in? It's still, I think, not much better for the whales.
Well, my personal opinion is I would, of course, like to see all captive animals
released
in a sanctuary. Yeah.
Or, okay, yeah, sanctuary, sure.
Yeah. And I think eventually that's the direction that zoos, like in 25 years, I would hope that people would look back and say, how could we have done that?
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
It takes time. It's a big ship, and it's moving slowly, but it is moving. And so that's probably SeaWorld's way of moving the ship. But eventually, you know, that's just not going to work. People are going to stop wanting to come see a whale jump up and get a ball. Yeah.
I'm with you. I can't be supportive of that. But that will be a topic for a different day. Wendy, we've got a couple minutes left. Do you have any special shout-outs or words of wisdom that you would like to give to fellow creatives out in the universe today?
Oh, you can watch all six episodes at www.mysisterisokay.tv. That's where our website is. It shows the stories of the actors and what the series is about. And I would just hope that it gets a really broad appeal. It's funny. We loved doing it. We loved writing it. And that's my shout out.
There we go.
I thank
right
you all
on.
So very much for having me on the show tonight.
Oh, Wendy, I loved having you. Rob and I were fighting over who was going to get to, you know, visit with you the most tonight. And I said, well, you know, we're going to have her back, so we'll try to split her equally.
Well, I'm sending you both many, 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 many kisses and hugs. And I thank you all so much for your radio
thank
show.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Have a great night, and we'll talk soon. Let's go grab that leaf of lettuce, okay?
Okay.
Okay, take care. And
all
so,
right.
Rob, this has been kind of a show on all ends of the spectrum. We've talked sobriety, your 34th anniversary. You're going to go race off here in just a couple of moments
right.
to go get your award for that. So congratulations. I want to hear all about that next week.
Thank you. Yeah.
And then
well, more than that, we went from
penises
to elephants.
The elephants. What a great story, though.
Oh, it was fascinating. Wonderful.
I have a couple of friends who are big elephant activists as well. And, you know, the stories that they tell are just so impassioned. And, you know, I don't know. I have a hard time believing that we're all not connected in some way. And I don't care if you're, I mean, I don't have much sympathy for spiders. So that's, or mosquitoes. Those are the two things that I probably don't have a lot of sympathy for. But, you know, pretty much everything else, I think we're all connected in some way.
Right.
So, I don't know. So how are you going to celebrate tonight? What are you going to do when you go to your award presentation?
Actually, I'm going to go see some people who've been important to me in just being supportive and that I've been there for too. So it'll just be kind of the subject of the evening. Then I'll come home and kiss my boys goodnight because that's probably one of the greatest rewards that has come about from that whole thing. So.
Well, congratulations to you again. I'm just very proud of you, and I'm proud to call you my friend, and I'm glad that we host this rated LGBT show once a week and, you know, for a long, 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 long time. And by the way, anybody, you know, like at Sirius or iHeartRadio, we are open to individual seven-figure contracts to bring us in as a team. So, you know, that would be fine for us. We'd be happy to do that anytime.
And my feelings are mutual. Along with the seven-figure contract.
Real quick, what are you doing Saturday night for the show?
Saturday night, I've got Eric Rossmore, who is promoting his book, Journey to Same-Sex Parenting. And wonderful book. I happen to be a chapter in the book, which is kind of cool just on its own. But we're going to have it's a fascinating book. It tells the story of all these different couples, and all of us chose a different way to become parents. And we go through those adventures. So it'll be a really good show.
That's an outinsantacruz.com, and that's at 7 p.m. Pacific time Saturday night. And tomorrow night on the Friday Night Dance Party, and I still have to upload his music into the studio, but he sent it to me earlier this week, Mr. Richard Halpern. He's going to be on talking about his new event that he's got coming up on Sunday, March 20th. I can't wait for him to be here. He's performing standards from the 20s and 30s that you will love. That will be an hour number one. We'll be talking to him about his musical career, but he's also better known as an Austin Powers impersonator at corporate events around the country. It is true. We will find out all about that tomorrow night, and that's at 7 o'clock. Hour number two tomorrow is going to be your request. So if you got him, phone him in, call him in, and get him to me so we can play him in tomorrow night's show. On behalf of Rob Watson and myself, it's a pleasure to have you here. Follow the show. Tell your friends to tune in, and we'll see you live tomorrow night. Have a great night, everybody.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.